For many of you, from the outside, looking into people who are addicts, their life and their lifestyle looks reasonably insane. That is, to the ability to spend every last cent on a horse or a poker machine and not have enough money to buy baby formula, to those on the outside looking in, it seems that person is not just selfish, but actually are slightly mad. And this will work not just for those types of addictions, but many other types of addictions, like the ability to drink and just to have one more drink, even though from the past experience you know that that one more drink is never enough, it'll lead to more, and it'll make you unable to cope with your job, it'll make you unable to cope with your education, it'll certainly make you unable to cope with your relationships, and you know that'll put you in a spiral of destruction, but yet you still do it. To those on the outside, it does seem that that person doesn't care about those that they are actually hurting. Or even other addictions which seem on the surface to be less, if you like, hurtful. The ability, if you like, to spend more money on shoes, more money on clothes, to spend more money than you actually have on your credit card, or need to get another credit card, or even to pay off the current credit card. It seems like that is not merely unwise, but selfish and self-destructive. Now, I myself don't come to this topic as a neutral observer. I remember the first time ever I walked into a tab. I was 15 years old. It was a school excursion. It was a commerce excursion, which I tended to skip and treat excursions like a day off. My nickname at school was Friday, because I never went. I used to have long weekends, which often stretched through to Tuesday. So I remember walking into the tab in the middle of the city, and this particular excursion that I attended to, I did actually skip. Within a few weeks, I was not merely missing school, but stealing money to fund my particular addiction. Within a few years, of course, all my rent, all my money was used to fund that. I got thrown out of uni because I never got past halfway at St. Leonard's, because I got off at St. Leonard's to go to the tab, and I got thrown out of uni for not attendance in the days where they usually keep a roll and do those types of things. So again, addiction is not a topic I come to as a neutral observer. So my, I suppose, interest in it has been because after becoming a Christian at 23, one of the things God had to deal with was not merely my addictive behaviour, but the actual thought process that goes along with it. I think I know the place of every town in Australia that has a trotting track, a horse track, or a dog track. Although I suspect in New South Wales that won't be going on much longer with our dog tracks, at least, anyway. But no doubt about it, the saddest place I've ever been to was Wentworth Park Gogs on a Saturday night, so the disappearance of such a thing, again, I'm not a neutral observer, doesn't strike me as such a bad thing. But again, addiction's not a topic I come to neutrally. My father, even though I myself, as a gambling addict from 15 through to 23, my father is still an alcoholic, has been for 55 years. His own father was an alcoholic, died of alcoholism in his early 60s from pancreatic cancer. And his father himself was an alcoholic as well. My mother, when she divorced my father when I was 13, she did so by getting involved with AA, or in that case, Al-Anon, which is the wives of alcoholics. My father couldn't really go to AA, or refused to go to AA. And after she got divorced, she remarried a drug and alcohol counsellor. And the reason we actually moved to Sydney when I was 14 was because my mother and stepfather were drug and alcohol counsellors with the Sydney City Mission. And so my family, in that sense, have been involved in this type of, if you like, addiction recovery industry for a long period of time. And many of you may think of addiction recovery in the same types of ways that the addiction recovery movement has popularized, really through the AA way of coping with addictions, especially since the 1960s. And that is, addictions are normally, or have been seen, to be similar to a disease. So addiction can be like a disease. So an addiction, when it's called a disease, tends to be something not merely you catch, but something, I suppose, that once it starts, you can't stop. And so, therefore, needs to be treated with counselling, with mentors, and with a constant, if you like, desire for you to take, you know, one day at a time, the AA type mantra. And their actual idea, of course, popularised through alcoholism being the first way AA was started up, was that addictions are treated by abstinence. You must stop, carte blanche, everything. in order to stay, in this case, sober, or to stay non-drug affected, or to not gamble again. Now, as I flag, my family still, a lot of them, I know my mother still holds to this type of view. We've had some discussions over recent years, but I actually think it conveys a couple of ideas which are a little bit unhelpful, as well as I don't think they're actually biblical. It can tend, I think, what I've seen in addiction recovery, to abdicate responsibility away from actually the addict. A disease type mentality is something that needs curing, yes, because that's what diseases need, but until you're actually cured, responsibility from the addict can tend to be everybody else's actual fault. Now, in reality, it's far more complex and far more, if you like, intricate than just saying the addict can't help it. Recent sort of addiction recovery theory really has actually had a lot more in common with the Bible, even though the people thinking about these issues on the whole are actually non-Christians. But God's word generally arrives at a solution to addictions which has got more to do with the physiology of who we are, our own biology, as well as our own behaviours that we bring to, if you like, our addiction, and our own family types experiences. So the answers are actually complex. But an addiction, in simple terms, is an action you must do. You have to do it. It's a dependency of an action. You have to do it. You survive by doing it. Your entire thought processes go into planning and orchestrating you to do it. So every addict I've ever met, sorry if this does not fit you, but most addicts I've ever met then, if it's not you, they're all compulsive liars. Every addict's a compulsive liar because you have to constrain or construct your relationships in order to maximize the ability for you to do the addiction and also to remove other people's ability to stop you doing it. So you get to lie to your family, you get to lie to your friends. In fact, my mother and stepfather were drug and alcohol counselors, and I was very good at keeping my addiction from them until I crashed my motorbike because I was intoxicated, but that wasn't the main problem. The main problem was I was also speeding, and it wasn't until then that they came in and saw the actual problems that were, you know, besetting my life, because addicts are good liars. So as we come through, the way God presents, I think, the causes of addiction are more than just saying you've got a disease which needs curing. The Bible's answer begins by saying that our brains are all out of whack. You may want to call that your sinful nature, if you like. And for some people, it's going to be so out of whack that they actually start developing addictive ways of coping with the problems or life in general. But all of us, in one sense, are out of whack. As a camera, our lens is out of focus, and the way we cope with the world is actually going to be not in accordance with the best possible ways we can live. Now, God will say in both our passages today that that is resulting from our desires not being able to be lived out in the correct way. So the first thing we're saying, our minds, our hearts are all out of whack. Secondly, there is a massive correlation between parental addiction and childhood addiction. In part, I don't think it's a mere genetic link, but more a link by circumstance. That is, my own father, I remember him telling me when I was about 13 that his first ever memory was as a 7-year-old. So I grew up in a town called Griffith, and he was about 30 k's out in a place called Gulgawi. And so his first memory was having his father sit him on a milk crate and strap things to his feet so he could reach the pedals of the car as a 7-year-old so he could drive him to the Merriwagga pub. That was his first memory. Now, what do you think one of my first memories was? The same thing. Not with the milk crate, though, but to the Griffith Hotel, where my father used to, or still does, actually drink. And so we actually perpetuate the same memories that often as children actually brought us hatred or loathing. But it's because they're the memories you know, that's the experience you know, that's what you grow up with doing. And so they're the things that you assume being normal. All my friends growing up were all children of alcoholics, because my father's friends were all alcoholics. I didn't know a painter who wasn't an alcoholic. They all drank. And so as I grew up and I had my 18th birthday party, I remember at the pub, and the barman comes up, or the publican says, "Oh, it's great to see you here celebrating your 21st. I go, "Oh, mate, I'm 18. He goes, "What do you mean? You've been drinking here for 3 years. Yeah, and well, gambling mainly for 3 years when I was on holidays with my father. So there is a massive correlation between parental and childhood addiction as well. We know that our desires are out of whack, by maybe caused by physiological reasons or biology. We're not sure about that. And lastly, we know that our own personality and how we cope with circumstances forces us to make different choices. My brother hates alcohol, refuses to drink alcohol. He had a very different reaction growing up in exactly the same family than I did. I didn't actually enjoy alcohol that much, but I enjoyed the surroundings that alcohol provided. Mateship with my dad's friends, a feeling of being a bloke at an earlier age, and gambling as well. So addictions are largely caused by what the Bible would call disordered affections. Alan mentioned that a little bit last week. The idea that is, it works in two ways. Firstly, all humans, whether you're an addict or not, you can love the right things the wrong way. Love the right things, but you can't do it right. You can't put it into practice right. So in one sense, alcohol is a neutral product, isn't it? But many people love it, and then they love it the wrong way. Sex, God-honoring, but you can actually be involved in pornography or involved in being a sexaholic. So you're loving a good thing the wrong way. The second thing, of course, is you can actually love the wrong things and therefore can't be right at all. And my personal opinion, you may want to chat to me about this afterwards, is that gambling, for example, is one of those types of things. Something that in and of itself is probably not a good thing for society to be actually engaged in. And so by loving that, you actually can't do it, can't do God's will, if you like, and be a gambler at the same time. But we'll come back to these ideas in a moment. So again, when we come to addictions, we're looking at what are the desires rather than the mere actions. So take gambling as an example. Not all addictions are the same in terms of the emotions that are actually being fed by it. Now, I know a lot of gamblers, or used to certainly, and I never met really a gambler whose chief problem was greed. It's not the chief problem. It's the surface issue that they're gambling money in order to, if you like, to make more money. No gamblers really want to lose, although if you play the poker machines with a 40% takeout rate for the state government, I suspect you've got some losing type coming your way. But generally speaking, they all know that. But yet, it's the ability to think you're the one. But the main thing about gambling, is in terms of what secular and Christian psychologists would say, is that it's an addiction not really about escapism so much, although it's part thereof, but the major focus is the desire for control, the desire to manipulate, the desire to win, the adrenaline thrill that goes with it. That diminishes for most addicts. I remember being in there and you'd gamble on like the Melbourne Cup and you see people massively jumping up and down, and most gamblers who got problems would just turn to the next part of the tab window and go to the next race. And it could be, you know, race 9 at Dacto or something, it wouldn't matter. Because the adrenaline thrill diminishes over time. And it's really just the power to control, the effect of doing the actions over and over again, the comfort that provides and those things. So for alcoholics, it can be quite different. For alcoholics, it can be quite complex as well. It can be, of course, from escaping pain of the past, as well as growing up in a parental situation by which that is the expected behaviour. That's what a man does, or that's what a woman does to cope with particular problems. I mean, that's how I got introduced to alcohol in that sense. As a 15-year-old, working with my father and then spending time with him, there's the things he did, that's what blokes did, and that's what how you live. And so that becomes the normal way of... But then, over time, that creates relational dysfunction by which the alcohol helps a person cope. Now, we all know alcohol is a depressant, and so it depresses the emotions. And so many people may be using alcohol to, if you like, depress emotions that they are unable to really give voice to. And so instead of getting help or counselling, they start using alcohol for those purposes to depress the emotions that they can't actually deal with or explain. That could even be as simple as a marriage that they can't talk to their partner about, they can't work through problems. And so in that sense, alcohol does have that escapist type idea, as other drugs and narcotics actually do. But it's not merely saying stop drinking, that alcohol is the problem. So most addiction recovery wants to look at not the surface issue, that is, stop gambling, you're just greedy, stop wasting money on alcohol, but actually what are the emotional triggers, the emotional support structures that a person is using to support that particular addiction. And of course, over the last 30 years, there's been a whole raft of different addictions that have been added, if you like, to different networks of addiction recovery. You may have networks for narcotics, of course, for gamblers, OCD, sexaholics, shopaholics, you name it. There is generally a support group that isolates out that particular addiction. So the complexity of addictions should make us rather slow to judgment, I hope, and very quick to compassion. But that's not the same as saying, and this is why the disease, I think, mentality of the past is not overly helpful, not completely incorrect, but not overly helpful, in the sense that we are slow to judgment, yes, quick to compassion, most certainly, but without absolving the addict of the entire responsibility. The addict is responsible for their actions. No one made me gamble. If you're an alcoholic here, no one makes you drink. There are circumstances which make it increasingly likely that you could become an addict. Increasingly likely. Your childhood, the way you were treated, abuse, the domestic violence, a whole raft of very, very important and sad issues that a person faces in life makes it increasingly likely. But still, the threefold things, your makeup of your brain, your parental and your life circumstances, but the third one is still important. You make a choice about how to cope with a variety of situations. And once that choice is made to cope in a certain way, it increasingly makes it more likely that that's the method you'll use to cope. So if you are an alcoholic or a drug addict, in other words, dependency type problems, you'll use those things if they're the ways you tend to use to cope. And over time, they form addictive behaviours and ways of coping. And because they do soothe an emotion, they make it increasingly hard, therefore, to get off. But the choice is yours. The choice was mine. That's how I chose to cope. And that's how all addicts choose to cope. But yet, we still need to be slow to judgment, quick to compassion, but without absolving responsibility. Because absolving responsibility doesn't always help that much. So the new theory on addiction, really, well, it's really just an old theory in the Bible, sort of like dressed up in newfound language, and that it actually does what God's word does in 2 Peter and in Ephesians chapter 4, and that is it focuses on desire. What are the desires, if you like, as a negative trigger which fuel the addictive actual behaviour? Now, just a small sidetrack when we get to desires, because we'll look at it in a moment from 2 Peter. Occasionally, and especially early on with addicts trying to recover, it takes a while for desire to actually catch up to behaviour. There is a lot of addicts who have a great heart to want to change, but don't have their desires and their actions actually mirroring one another. So they want to stop, but they don't possess the strength to stop. And the good news is that we have the answer for that. Now, many people over the years, actually, the statistics are actually pretty similar. AA never liked to popularise this. Sorry if you're an AA person listening. And that is the percentage of people who give up, alcohol is where they've done the stats, the percentage of people who give up alcohol without going to any addiction recovery network or mentoring group is very similar after 5 years of those who do. In other words, for those who have stayed sober longer than 5 years, the stats of, this is obviously American stats, are actually very similar. And what that demonstrates to us is that there's another thing at play. And the thing at play really is the person taking charge and actually wanting their desires actually changed. You need your desires changed. Except, of course, the problem is that generally speaking, when you are an addict, as I use myself as an example, I worked to get money to gamble. I organised my family structures and how I spent time with my family, how I spoke to my family in order to maximise my time to gamble. So I didn't need just to stop gambling. I had to change the way I spent time with my family, how I told the truth, how I actually, if you like, lived my entire life. So the problem for most addicts is not just the stopping of something. It's the reordering of their personality. It's the reordering of their desires. And sometimes it takes a while for the desires to be reordered enough that their actions actually follow. And occasionally what an addict will need to do is put steps in place in order to not do an action, even though they know their desires haven't caught up yet. They need to stop going to a hotel, even though they want to stop. They've got to not go there, for the temptation to go will actually deprive them of the ability to not drink. If they go, they'll drink. I never walked into a tab and walked out after race one. It just didn't happen. I'm walking out after race eight, whether I had money or not. And by the time I stopped, well, I stopped gambling 20 years ago, and so the tab wasn't open as much at night then, but now it's 24/7. We used to go to Star City most nights, and if you know you've been in Star City, you don't know what time of day it is generally, especially back in the 90s, where you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, you wouldn't have a clue what time of day it was. And they used to have the ATMs, you know, in there. That was a government force to get in the force and to move them outside. Because, of course, most times the addict won't stop if they're in the vicinity of the place that actually gave them the problem. So what we need to do is not be, again, harsh, but not also advocate responsibility that if an addict does lapse, it's not the end of the world. It's a part, hopefully, of them coming to repentance, asking God to change their desires, and this being one of those steps that their desires, hopefully, over time, will catch up to their actual behaviour that God will have them. Now, on the screen, hopefully will come the first passage here from 2 Peter. Let me read it to you, and I hopefully you'll see the link between desires and actually action. So verse 3 says, His divine power has given us everything we need for life and good godliness through our knowledge of Him who called us by His own glory and goodness. Through these, He has given us His very great and precious promises, so that through them you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption in the world caused by evil desires. Now, evil desires aren't something that are a part of other people and not you. Evil desires are a part of all of us. That's another way of saying that they're our disordered affections. That's us loving the right things the wrong way. That's us loving the wrong things, and you can't do it the right way. There is no right way to love the wrong things. Our evil desires that are in each one of us lead us all to following the wrong things. For some of us, because the world is so whacked, our minds don't reflect what it looks like to live a proper life. And addictions is one way that people cope. So it says, verse 5, for this very... I've got to tell me, I get you to wave your hand when I actually get to the end of the verse. It's not coming up here, but over there. So verse 5, for this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. So you can see the link that to escape evil desires is the first premise to actually being a Christian. It's the first premise to actually doing all those linear actions that follow in a logical sequence. You can't practice godly goodness, godly brotherly kindness, if your desires are still for evil. It just doesn't work that way. And so the great news for Christians is, and the great news for non-Christians is, now as I said, many people give up an addiction without becoming a Christian. But we want to say we know the cause of all addictions. It's the same cause for all sin. And we're all living it, whether you're an addict or not. And I suspect a reason why AA has had such a good, if you like, ability to help addicts over the years is because a minister was a guy who helped write it at the start. It's because addicts know one thing. They can't stop. Every addict knows one great truth. Shame. Shame. The shame of not being the person that they want. Every addict knows that they're hurting their beloved family. They're not stupid. And so when the gospel is preached to them, they don't need to be convinced, if they come to Christ, that they need love. They need forgiveness. The trouble with most Australians, they just don't realise how evil they really are. But the addict, he knows. She knows. And so when they hear the gospel, they know that there's one answer. Continue in your self-denial, self-delusion, self-help and self-strength that you've always failed in. And if you do succeed, it doesn't help you with God at all. Or come to God, because you need a heart transplant. The same way that every person needs one. It's just the addict knows it, because he's failed in this world, or she has, enough to know it. So God says we need a heart transplant. And now the next verse that will come up here from Ephesians, just starting from verse 22, says it even clearer, I think, from Ephesians 4. It says, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off the old self, which has been corrupted by what? Deceitful desires. taught is back in verse 20, you're taught by Christ to cast off these desires. What's the consequence of that? Verse 23, to be made new in the attitude of your minds. That's the key thing. Christ can help you be made new in the attitude of your minds. And the result is that now you can put on the new self, the new Christian self with a heart transplant. Why? Because now you're created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Consequence? Well, therefore, it says, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbour. Non-Christians can do that. This has no relevance for God. It doesn't have any help to actually being a Christian. It says, for all members of one body. So what we also need to affirm is that desire is where not merely addiction is at, but where the Christian life is at. We need to witness to ourselves and maybe to our friends and family that I am not holier than they are. There is only one type of person, and that is the person whose desires actually remove them from the love of God, unless they come to him and see in God's love the need for a heart transplant. And I reckon addicts often see that more clearly than actually some other people do. So I needed to change not merely my action, but every thought that went along with my actions. So as we struggle, for those who are addicts, don't think that the first relapse you have means you're not a Christian. Hopefully it's a sign that your desires will take time to catch up to your behaviour. But it doesn't mean you absolve the person. So if you're a person who is helping a friend or a family member, a relapse is not okay. Never say it's okay. It is a sign that our desires are still out of whack more than they should be with the grace that we've received from Jesus Christ. But what do? You point them back to Christ and you point them to repentance. That as they confess that sin, God does forgive them. And ask them to pray prayers that their desires will be changed to be more like Jesus Christ. Now, this is the probably more controversial section to end with. And I think it's where the Bible gets us to if our focus is on desires, not on abstinence. Now, it should be obvious that as the Addiction Recovery Network broadened its approach out from alcohol into other areas of life, that they had to ask themselves the question, is abstinence the answer to addiction? Now, on the surface, with alcohol, it seems the case, or with opioids or other types of behaviour modification drugs, because it seems that by engaging in those again, you're going to relapse into the same, you know, coping mechanisms. But of course, a sexaholic or a shopaholic or a person with OCD tendencies like washing their hands, abstinence is not where we're trying to get them to. A person who is married, who's been a sexaholic, has a sex addiction, abstinence is not the answer, is it? As a Christian, you want them to learn new desires about God-honouring sex, isn't it? For a person who's a shopaholic, never going to the shops again is not the answer. Otherwise, they'll starve to death and be walking around naked. You get arrested for other things. Not going to go so well. What's the answer? The answer is that the person's desires could be changed so that they don't feel the same temptations in the same environment that provided them with the temptation before. So if we ask the question again, can an alcoholic drink? Well, the answer previously has been no. Can a gambler gamble again socially? Can a drug addict take drugs socially? Now, the frame of reference is desire and behaviour that flows from that desire and whether the product itself has moral qualities. So gambling, this is me, you may have different views on this, I believe gambling is not morally neutral. Gambling at its core is people pooling their money into a third party called a tab or a government or a bookmaker by which they take a share, depending over a poker machine, with 40%, or bookmakers normally 20 to 25%, and most people lose. The whole point of it is to get money from other people. You don't get it from a bookmaker. They're like the intermediary who holds it for them. They take their share, and then they pull everybody else's money out, depending on what odds they were, to someone else. Your whole premise for getting money is to take it off someone else. I don't see gambling as a morally neutral product. So therefore, if my desires have changed, my desire now is to not gamble at all, whether socially is irrelevant. I don't see the product being that good. And that, I think, works for drugs and drug addiction. It's a product that doesn't help you. Now, whether it's marijuana or heroin, those products could be used for medicinal purposes and by people for the right purposes in a medically controlled environment. But that's not how 99% of people use them. They use them as coping mechanisms for problems. So I can't see how there's a positive way that those could actually work. Alcohol. Now, alcohol is a neutral product, isn't it? Jesus turned water into wine. Now, the same things that work with alcohol, though, do work with drugs. And that is, they do change your biological makeup. They do change your way of thinking. And so for some alcoholics, and for many, abstinence is a good thing. Because the coping mechanisms, as well as the destructive mechanisms they employed under the influence of alcohol, in its poorest form, domestic violence, for example, those things are not something that the person should be wanting to engage in again. But do you know what? It's a very high percentage of people, more higher than we would like to think of the top of our heads, for people who were classified as alcoholics who do enjoy drinks socially again. And the reason for that is that their desires have changed. They don't have the same ways of coping with the problems that they did in the past. And some have been able to return to social drinking. But I suspect for many alcoholics, this will not be the way they will learn how to cope. But abstinence as a concept is not the controlling mechanism for addictions. The controlling mechanism is desire, changing your desires to be more akin to God's desires. Because that works whether you're a sexaholic, porn, or other types of addiction. And as we end, I just wanted to show you this on the screen. This, I suppose, is a way of thinking through addictions. Oh, the L's gone down a line on criminal. It's not crimina, it's not a fancy sort of new Latin word. So some things, plain out illegal, and therefore the person should be prosecuted. Whether it's an addiction or not is actually irrelevant. So pedophilia, psychopathy, illicit drugs, some pornography, kleptomania, which is shoplifting and stealing as an addiction, those things are criminal. So the person needs to face the consequences of their behaviour, the consequences of their actions. I've got the list there, unable to do again. And they're in order, in some sense. So pornography, there's no helpful pornography. So if you're a person who has suffered from porn addiction and are coping, you're moving that your desires would actually be reflective of a person who doesn't engage in it at all. There's no dabbling that is actually any good at all. A gambling, self-harm as well. So as they go down, prescription drugs, alcohol, tobacco, pyromania. You might not agree with tobacco being in that list there, but I think it's in the list below. And then you get down way down to the bottom. And you get down shopping, overeating, workaholics, caffeine, and many OCD tendencies. The aim of those, of course, is that their desires can be retrained so that the person can do the activities without their desires making them be forced to do temptation. And the four broad categories there are pretty well true for most addictive behaviours. Substance disorders is point one. We want, if we can help a person, to not engage in those at all. Impulse behaviours generally don't work very well long term. Gambling, kleptomania, pyromania. Behavioural addictive behaviours, they're the ones we're more wanting to try and retrain those person's desires. Because they're often everyday things. They're often the things in everyday life, they're the good being done badly. That's when our desires are out of whack. Something good, like work, like sex, like OCD, like shopping. But porn is in that list because it is an addictive behavioural behaviour. It's not something you want them to participate in because it's up there as the unable. And an addictive psychological. That's when a person most definitely is going to need some counselling to work with their addiction. Because there are deep psychological reasons why they do it. That's why self-harm is up there at the top as well, unable. Because there's coping mechanisms for self-harm that are actually very harmful to the person's long-term emotional well-being. And so if you have a family or friend member who is in addictive psychological, you can be a part of getting them help in a way that actually leads them to getting involved with counselling. They will need to do it. They won't be able to cope by themselves. Many people who are alcoholics have been able to cope by themselves, but many won't. But I suspect many now in addictive psychological won't be able to cope at all. That's the reason they're in that bracket. They need you to be, if you like, their helping hand and helping arm. Now, in your order of in your bulletin there. I just put some references and some helpful things there. Come and speak to me about afterwards. I'm not going to speak to them. There's a whole raft of things in that list that are Christian and non-Christian. Most of those are local. The only one I've had a personal contact with is Overcomers Outreach, which is a Christian version of AA, really, but for all addictions, not just alcoholism. And they currently meet at Laylaw Park. I have been talking to Penny Wilkinson, who runs OO, about having an OO meeting here from next year, possibly once a fortnight or once a week, with possibly myself running that as the facilitator. So hopefully that'll get up and running. But there are a list of things in there. My suspicion will be the first thing you can do is, if the person wants help, is go to your GP. You have a good GP. Go see a medical professional, seek medical help, get a referral to a medically funded place that your GP can put you into. The Nepean District has a lot of those particular facilities on site. Some of them are, most of them are actually, if you like, opioid or amphetamine based, but many aren't. But most addictions have somewhere within about a 10 to 15K radius, a support group aimed at people helping that person cope. And in consultation with a GP and you wanting to move forward, that's how you can do it. Now, just to summarise, hopefully you hear me say, addictions are those combination of those three things. Something's not right with the addict's mind, yes. That's true for all of you. Something's also not right quite often with the way they've coped with the past, and so they've developed addictive behaviours. We don't know what those past problems are. So it should make us very slow to judgment, quick to compassion, but without ever absolving them of their responsibility to take charge of their own behaviour. And the first thing God says to take charge in doing is saying, I might be able to stop or not, I don't know. But unless God deals with my desires, I won't know the love of God. And that's the first point I need to get right. Now I'm going to pray, and I'm going to close our time of prayer with the confession that will come on the screen that we can all pray together. So I'm going to open in prayer and leave a bit of time where people can bring their sins to God. Because if you're an addict here, or you're a family that has addicts in it, one thing you know very well is shame and guilt. And so God, He deals with that. So let us pray.